there. Welcome to Cageless, a conversation podcast about experiential wisdom and personal hope. I'm Jenny Johnson. I'm a writer, and I'm asking experts, thought leaders, and my friends to share their knowledge and tools on how they found freedom. Welcome to season one.
Oh, that's kind of like a little bit of like ASMR here at the beginning. I apologize, everyone. I'm slightly under the weather today, which I don't think I'm under the weather. I think that the weather is over me because I have terrible allergies. Welcome to spring. Spring is starting to become one of my favorite seasons. I have increasingly become more grateful that seasons exist because I used to very much just be a summer 24/7. I want it to be hot and sunny. My body temperature runs pretty cold, so like it being warm outside and the sun being out has always been good for me, and has made me happy. But I'm grateful for spring, and I'm grateful that winter exists because spring can't exist without it, and that flowers grow, and that it's just a reminder that new life can exist. So that being said, what a great segue. I didn't even do that on purpose. New life exists. Today's episode is going to be maybe the hardest thing I've ever talked about out loud. So yeah, I'll just get into it. I have struggled with an eating disorder my entire life. And I say my entire life, my entire awareness life. And on today's episode, I'm going to be speaking with someone who I don't think I'd be alive today if I didn't come across her and her help. So essentially, a spark notes of the first time that I can remember engaging with disordered eating behaviors and thoughts was probably around 8 years old. Whenever I started to perceive women outside of myself that looked differently than I did. And anyone who has grown up in our culture that has identified as a female, we all know that comparison is quite the monster. And so it's almost sick to think of an 8-year-old like comparing herself to a photo that she saw on a magazine in the grocery store line with her mom. But I did. It was, you know, integrated into my little mind that like what I looked like mattered. And so I remember like holding my stomach when I would like lay in bed at night, just this like little 8-year-old that like didn't have abs, you know, like Christina Aguilera or whatever. And it's like, oh, well, like, no duh, because that's not how 8-year-olds bodies, you know, look inherently typically. And I come from a family that isn't necessarily, you know, metabolism wise more on the like thinner side naturally, but not necessarily on the overweight side either. Which is a really wicked thing because culturally we are expected to be more on the thin side, or like be like being thin is like better. And like I'm so tiptoeing around a lot of words right now because I don't want to discredit anyone's experience or life, but this is my experience and my life. And I just remember growing up and thinking like, oh, I don't look like, you know, the people that I see on TV or like the women that are also performing that I'd like to look like, because I'd like to be at their caliber of, you know, performance or like their caliber of success or whatever. And my parents, I remember growing up, were pretty health conscious people. They were aware of the things that they were putting on the table for my brother and I. And, you know, that was kind of like socially how much I remember that part of like the beginning of my eating disorder. And as women get older in this world, we start to be infected by a lot of different opinions from a lot of different directions. And whether that is your friends, your whatever media you're consuming through your eyes and your ears, through your schooling, through teachers, coaches, the things that you're involved in, your religious institutions. I don't like pointing the finger at one particular sector of my life where my disordered eating, you know, originated. But because sometimes issues happen from a perfect storm. So that all being said, this is something that I'm willing to be a lot more open about now that I am in active recovery. We will get a little bit more into specifics of my journey with anorexia and my journey with my body and the perception of it. So today we're talking about what eating disorders actually are and how we can speak about them and be honest about them and how recovery can exist and that there is hope at the end of a disease that is aiming to do nothing but kill you, even though it tries to convince you otherwise. So if you are going to continue listening to this episode today, it's just my prayer that these words educate you and bring awareness to you and hopefully bring some hope to you or anyone that you love that has questioned having an eating disorder, has actively struggled with one, because kind of, you know, why I felt the need to speak about this at this point, at 26 years old in April of 2022, is that I am embarking on an adventure through a couple of different countries, and I really want to speak about the food and the culture and the experience that I'm going to embark on candidly, because a part of my active recovery is doing things that are out of my comfort zone and engaging with new experiences that are going to continue to push me toward health and happiness. With all of this being said, I just want to be honest. So if you want to continue to listen to this episode, please do if you feel like you are at a spot where you can. And I will say there is a lot of very honest dialogue in this episode that could possibly be triggering to you. So if you do think that that's you, there is all love there and acceptance and patience in the process, and like knowing when you can say yes and when you can say no is important. So however you can best love yourself today, in whatever direction you feel like you need to be gentle with yourself, please, please, please go in that direction. But I'm so grateful to have you to talk to, because part of my recovery is being able to speak about it. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to heal loudly. So with that being said, I hope that you enjoy this week's episode of Cageless. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cageless. It is a beautiful spring day here, which I'm actually in Texas today, which is exciting and also a little bit ironic because my special, special guest today is also in Texas. Ironically, we're not in the same room, but that's okay. We have spent some time in the same room before. This person that I am interviewing has been someone that has been an integral part of my life. Her help is one of the reasons why I'm still alive. So this is Miss Mandy Pizarczyk. Hi, Mandy.
Hey, thank you for that introduction.
Yes, absolutely. Mandy is a trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapist. She is a professional counselor that specializes in eating disorders. Mandy, how did you start in this line of work? Because it is a very specialized line of work. Can you tell me a little bit about your background?
Yeah, it is. So when I got my bachelor's degree in social psychology, I had an assignment on my last semester of what kind of job can you get with the social psychology degree. So I came across a child life specialist. And so I thought, yeah, this is perfect. I'd love to do this. And what they do is go in the hospital and kind of educate families and work with the kids in preparation for surgeries or any other kind of procedure. And towards the end of my internship, I thought, well, what's next? My two mentors there both had their master's degree in counseling. And so I figured, okay, I'll do this. And so my specialty is actually in my master's degree is marriage, family, and couples counseling. Because I figured obviously can't work with the kid unless you're dealing with the whole family. Upon graduation, I knew I always wanted to work with kids. I knew I always wanted to work in the hospital. And so I got a job at Children's kind of through networking of somebody else who was in my cohort, and it was on the eating disorder unit. So I had never experienced working with eating disorders. Truthfully, I didn't understand it. And I started out as a milieu therapist on the unit there. And then I went up and got to work as an intern there as a counselor. And then I'm now here I am as a fully licensed family and individual therapist at the hospital and in private practice.
Gotcha. And why? I guess because there's a lot of different ways that you can go when it comes to counseling, therapy, psychology. Do you know, like, was there a specific instance that you were like, I think I want to work with like kids, or like, I think that this is kind of the route that I want to go? Did you grow up working with kids, babysitting? What kind of route? How did that happen?
Yeah, absolutely. Always worked with kids my whole life. My first jobs were babysitting jobs, and then I worked in a nursery at a church, and then pretty much every job from like 16 through like 22 was at some sort of daycare facility. And so I always kind of gravitated towards that. I've always been able to work really well and really easily with kids, so I knew that was something that just came natural to me.
And are you, see, I already know the answers to these questions, but I love that everyone else is getting to learn about you. Are you married? Do you have kids?
I'm not married and I do not have kids. Yeah. It makes it easier for me to be able to work with kids and then go home and not have my own.
Right. And like not have to deal with like both ends, like work and life. I know that work-life balance is really important for you. You work in a vocation that is heavy, I would say. I wouldn't say that it's like, and not, I'm, this is not to discredit like a kindergarten teacher, but it's like you're not like teaching the ABCs to people.
Right.
It's more like you're like unteaching the ABCs to people, honestly. How do you have that work-life balance? Because you, like I said, you work with people on such like a heavy subject. Do you feel like you're like a really like deep person? Or like, how do you like balance out like having fun versus like your work?
I've always been really good at compartmentalizing. So I've never had an issue with that, right? I never let personal flow into work or work flow into personal. And so I set really good boundaries, even just at work with coworkers. I set really good boundaries with myself. And truthfully, I mean, I know maybe not to toot my own horn, right? But like I leave my session with some kind of closure. So I'd never leave a session and I never leave work with something that I think I should have said, or that if safety is in concern, like I never leave work thinking like, oh, I should have told them to do this instead of that, right? Like I feel like I've gotten really good at circling around in sessions so that there really aren't any open-ended things where I have to go home and like, oh man, this is what I should have said or done. And maybe that happened in the beginning, but I've gotten a lot better with that. And so yeah, I find it really easy to say, here's what we're doing and the focus is on right now. And then I'm happy and I'm comfortable letting them leave and work on those things.
That's so good. And I'm allowed to say that I was your patient, right? I am. Okay. I know that in all of our sessions, I felt that way with you. And it's really difficult, I have found, to be with a therapist or a licensed mental health professional where you feel more of like an exhale when you leave instead of like, oh, I have homework to do, or like, oh, I have a lot of different things to do, which with eating disorders, it is something that you have to do every day because you have to eat every day. I found that working with you, it was a lot easier to talk about things and like let them out versus like having something to do.
Right.
You do cognitive behavioral therapy, yes.
Right.
How did you come about that type of therapy versus all of the other different kinds that you can possibly do specifically with like eating disorders? Why do you think that CBT is beneficial?
It helps with regulating those emotions, right? And coming to an understanding of your emotions and figuring out how maybe a change needs to occur. And so bringing awareness to that and kind of the symptoms of the eating disorder and how they affect you going forward, it's really this retraining of your thoughts and your brain. And it's, you have to have this big understanding of how these thoughts are affecting my behaviors and my urges. And so this kind of helps for you to kind of take, it's almost taking you back to the basics of like, let me identify these feelings. Mm-hmm. Let me get my emotions in regulation and like in check so that I can be able to implement them and be able to push back and fight this eating disorder.
Right, right. And backpedaling just a little bit, what is your definition of, and this can be a textbook definition or like your personal definition of what is an eating disorder?
So it can be tricky, right? Because I think a lot of people can say, oh, I've experienced symptoms of this eating disorder. I probably would say everyone has experienced disordered eating at some point in their life. And so it includes obviously this great fear of gaining weight, this great fear of what is this going to do to my body? How does this affect me personally and my personal relationships with other people? I never understood the intense psychological aspect of eating disorders, right? It's more than just like, oh, I don't want to eat that. Oh, I don't want to be fat. Oh, I'm prepping for a vacation or something, right? It's this true, deep psychological thing. And usually those thoughts are the last thing to be fixed or cured or healed. And so eating is literally the tip of the iceberg. That's the tip of it. You can eat, you can do all of those things, but it's all of these really distorted thoughts and behaviors that come with this great fear.
Right. And do you think that it's important that people understand the difference between, like you said, like prepping for a vacation versus having an eating disorder? Because I know, well, first of all, as a woman that's living in the West, in America, we are almost fed, ironically enough, to be people of disordered eating. Like, it is almost praised to have this type of, like, discipline towards eating.
Right.
So is it important for people to understand the difference between dieting and actually like having a hindrance in your head?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a really fine line between all of that, right? And I think kind of the thing is, if you're dieting for a certain reason, it's a really fine line that could mean you have an eating disorder, that could turn into an eating disorder. It takes a lot of self-awareness. And I think this part, it's this tricky dynamic of like with the eating disorder, someone feels like I have so much control and that's why I use this eating disorder as a form of control, and not really recognizing that they're absolutely out of control. Mm-hmm. And this eating disorder is completely encompassing and making all of these decisions. Mm-hmm. And so trying to like even separate those things, I always encourage my clients, right? Like, listen to your eating disorder voice, or is this your voice? Mm-hmm. And I understand it's not this like man voice inside your head, or woman voice, right? Inside your head telling you these things. Like, I get it. They're your thoughts, they're your feelings, they're your truths. But if you took a step back and you thought, is this beneficial for me? How is this hurting me? And thinking like a thought that comes with food, is it rational? Is it not rational? So helping people understand that, I think, is the biggest part of kind of deciphering, is this an eating disorder? And it has to come from the individual themselves.
Right, which is why I also think that like working with you and being able to process with someone who, first of all, it was in my journey of recovery, it was really important that I felt understood by someone. And you were someone that had a similar experience in life just in general, which being someone that was raised in the same social climate, you know, that I was, it was important that you and I had that like baseline language, because I believed you when I had the opportunity to speak really candidly about the thoughts going in my head, that you could debunk those with me and then also implement things in a language that I spoke. Did you, with any of your like personal experience, because I love talking to therapists and asking like, okay, like as a therapist, who do you go to for help? Like, can the therapist be like therapized? Have you ever encountered disordered eating thoughts before you started working in this profession?
Like me personally?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think I have. And there were times where maybe before I could think like, do I have an eating disorder? Right. Mm-hmm. Like it, but then kind of thinking like, okay, until I actually worked with people who have gone through this, like I said before, it's this truly deep psychological thing that I didn't understand before. And so, yeah, I mean, I definitely have experienced times where I'm like, okay, I need to prep for this. I need to prep for that. Right. But the big component, I think, is that I have been able to snap out of it. It wasn't something that turned into kind of this obsession of I need to continue with this going forward. With adults, it's helping them understand and put into perspective of like, how do I get out of this kind of cycle, right? And I ask every single client, when would your eating disorder ever be satisfied? And almost every single time, the answer is when I'm dead. I think that kind of helps put things into perspective and bringing some awareness to really understanding kind of someone else's own perception of, am I dieting and getting ready for a trip? Am I wanting to work out to lose weight? Is there an end point? And usually with an eating disorder, there's no end point.
No, absolutely not. And I remember specifically you asking me that question and having to answer that honestly, which you can go into therapy and be as dishonest as you like, right? But at the end of the day, it's like, am I spending all of my time and my money and investing in trying to get better to be dishonest? Because that's kind of what your eating disorder wants you to do. Any type of disordered thought, any type of mental illness is going to be that voice in your head that is trying to convince you of something that isn't honest and truthful. And when you have to kind of basketball with someone else that you feel like you can trust and understand and say, when will this demon sickness, illness inside of me be satisfied? And you have to answer, when I'm dead. Unfortunately, sometimes it has to come to that point. I know that I came to you at an intersection of my life where it was either I was going to continue engaging in disordered eating behaviors and not just disordered eating, which I'm sure that you see a lot in people. It's not just that. It's like all of your control issues can kind of fester into different parts of your life. So my life was it was unraveling, right? And so it's like I'm either going to ravel back or I'm going to continue unraveling until I'm dead. So if you can, for our listeners, if you could like break down the types of eating disorders there are into like more of a like simplistic definitions. Because when I think of eating disorders, I think of there's bulimia, there's anorexia. But what would you say are like kind of the main, you know, I guess like overall blankets of eating disorders?
Yeah, so but obviously, I think the main ones that people mostly know about is like anorexia nervosa, which would mean that you are under your ideal body weight, and that's determined right by a dietitian, by your physician, and then you're engaging in eating disorder behaviors of restricting. And then there's anorexia nervosa, like binge purge type. So you're underweight, you are binging and you are purging. And there's a tricky aspect to that one, because if someone is anorexic and they think they should only be eating 3 strawberries a day, but then they're eating 7 strawberries a day, they might see that as a binge, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's clearly not. And so understanding binge purge is different, and it's tricky, I think, for sometimes people who are experiencing it to kind of decipher. Then there's atypical anorexia, which you're in your healthy body weight or maybe above your healthy body weight, but you are engaging in restricting behaviors. And then there is unspecified eating disorder. And so that one is more of kind of you're in that weight range where you should be, right? And I say should be as like a very loose term. So it's all different for everybody, but still engaging in these behaviors. There is also ARFID. And I think that one typically happens more with like the younger kids, where it's called ARFID, so avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And so that one is more of people who don't eat because of a fear of choking, right? Maybe a little kid ate something and then they got really sick, and then they're afraid to eat because they are going to think they're going to get sick again. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes working with the younger ones, we think they're ARFID, or even teenagers or adults can think they're ARFID. And then the kind of deciding point between that and a traditional diagnosis would be, is it in conjunction with a fear of gaining weight? Mm-hmm. And so that kind of helps turn that one into a different diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're talking candidly in terms of like very like definition, like textbook wise. But how do you, because working with kids and would it be incorrect to assume that you work with a lot of women?
That's not incorrect. I'd say mostly mm-hmm. women.
How is this like a checklist of like, if you could ask someone a couple of questions, how do you diagnose someone with an eating disorder?
By asking questions about behaviors. The behaviors are like the key thing here. So if they are actively restricting, if they're actively hiding food, if they're actively purging, over-exercising, if it's really interfering with their personal life and like, I didn't go to this party because I knew I was going to have to eat there, or I went to this party and I immediately went into the restroom and threw up. And so the biggest thing for me in diagnosing that is the behavior, because you can't look at someone and tell that they have an eating disorder every single time. And that's kind of one of the biggest misconceptions and kind of things that we're gearing away towards trying to like the greater public to know, is that you can't always just look at someone, and it's not always this person who's skinny who has an eating disorder. And if they're overweight or in their healthy weight range, they don't, because they're not skinny. And so really getting to know and understand thoughts, patterns, how they process through these distortions, and the intensity of all of these things help me kind of come to that conclusion of saying, okay, yeah, this would be a diagnosis for an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I have worked with a lot of people that it has been almost too personal. As like a therapist, they try to kind of like be my friend. And then I've also worked with people that it's much easier when you're facing a demon, like, which would you consider like an eating disorder, like an evil entity outside of someone else? Or do you think that it's more of like a social conditioning thing?
All of the above, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, it's hard to kind of determine this. And I don't think it's ever even truly a goal of mine as somebody's therapist to find the root. We can get there sometimes, and sometimes that's important. But starting at the root and going forward is not really like my style. Mm-hmm. I basically start like, okay, where are you at now? Like, how is this affecting you now? And then those other pieces start to fit. And there is no perfect answer for how and why this started. There may be bits and pieces of somebody's life that they can say, yeah, I remember this, that stuck with me. But it's almost like this perfect storm of things that creates the eating disorder. And so kind of my way to go about it is say, okay, where are you at now? Like, where are you at now? Recovery is such this big thing. And I know we have big goals for you in recovery, but where are you now and how can I meet you there and then still push you? And I think all these other puzzle pieces start to come together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is it's the approach that I don't want to say worked, because recovery in general is such a vast subject that we'll get into. But also, ironically, you can only chew one bite at a time. You try to dig into your past or figure out, you know, this is why, because my mom did this, or a kid in school said this, or I was raised this way, or whatever, until you can have someone look you in the eye and say, why did you not go to this party? Period. Question, or question mark. That's one question that we have to answer today. And I like I said, I have found that when you can speak candidly to yourself, because the eating disorder is lying to you all of the time anyway. So whenever you can answer one question honestly, that changed everything for me. Where do you find your support for your own mental health and the things that you're going through in your head? Because I can imagine you have so many, obviously, not crazy. I don't want to call myself crazy, or anyone that struggles with any type of mental illness crazy, but lots of chaotic thoughts and things, because you're great at compartmentalizing, right? How do you stay sane, as a mental health professional?
I mean, I have a lot of friends in the field, right? So I get to go to them. I always have somebody that I'm able to decompress with if I have a really stressful session or if something's really bothering me. I have a great network at the hospital that I work at where I can always kind of talk to a coworker and then let it out and be like, okay, I'm good to go. Here at the practice, I have a really amazing practice owner. We're able to talk and decompress after anything too. And so when we meet, it's like, where do I go from here? How do I do this? And knowing too, and I do feel really confident in my work and in things that I do. And so there's not a lot of times that I need to kind of fix things that I've done wrong or right. Like there's not a lot of that. And so, and then I have a lot of just amazing friends that, if I can go out hiking, if I can go out and doing things, I definitely try to keep that balance in place too.
It's potent to have a mental health professional assist you that is also assisting herself. You know, there's a baseline of trust when you can have someone that's also taking care of themselves help take care of you.
Yeah.
That being said, has there been anyone in your personal life that has reached out to you for any type of mental health disordered eating issues that you've had to be actually this isn't this is my personal life, I can point you towards someone else? Or how have you navigated anything like that?
I have, and they're really respectful of my boundaries as well. I have had a friend where it's like, okay, I'm hearing you and there's really only so much I can do. And as a friend, I want to find solutions. As a friend, I want to say, no, don't do this. That's not right. Stop it right now. And as a therapist, I can't do that. So I don't turn it off for my friends. I don't put on a therapy hat when I'm with them. And so I'm like, hey, here's my opinion and here's how you should handle this situation. And if you're still struggling with it, maybe you do need to go talk to somebody else who can help you really process deeply into these things. I don't allow myself to put on my therapy hat with my friends. I just think it's way too personal and I can't take my opinion out of it when it comes to friends.
Right. Which you are so good. I think something that left a mark on me is how candid you spoke to me. of just kind of like and I do think that a lot of people that I know that have had eating disorders are we're smart a lot of the time, obviously. And we can be manipulative, even with the people that are trying to help us, but like especially the people in our life. And I was never able to lie to you. You're a professional unmanipulator, honestly. Do you think that you've always had that superpower?
I think I've always been really good at that. I can really kind of hear people. I can kind of know when it's not truthful, and I can confront in a gentle way. I'm very transparent, and this was something that got told to me during my master's degree by one of my professors, and she said, "One of your strengths is your transparency."
That's right.
And so I think I really relate with, and that's why I've come to really love working with adults, because I can provide that, and it's always like, tell me where you're at. You have to tell me where you're at. Otherwise, this is pointless for both of us, because then I'm going to have expectations that you're not going to meet, and you're going to be wasting your time. And especially working in private practice, like, you're paying for me out of pocket. You're spending your time. You're not obligated to be here. Maybe sometimes people are obligated by family, by friends, right? But like, there really is no true obligation for you to be here. And I want people to make the most out of their time here. And I can't give that to them if I'm not transparent with them either.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that that's such a superpower of yours. And do you feel like you have that superpower with yourself, being able to be really honest with yourself?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I think that's part of kind of how I got lucky into this field and why I feel really good when I come to work and when I do these things, because I can do that for myself, and I don't let, outside experiences affect how I treat and work with my clients.
Absolutely. And I don't think that it's ironic now that I think about it. It makes a lot of sense that working with kids, because kids are the most honest and ruthless beings a lot of the time. They kind of like don't have this like outer world filter just yet. If you ask a kid, does this shirt make me look bad? They're going to be like, yeah, it does.
Kids need that kind of pretty straight to the point. They don't need, otherwise, if you sugarcoat around it with kids, that's when you get manipulated by kids. I guess sometimes I too just have a really direct, and like I said, I can confront and I'll do it. We're getting to the point here, and there's no kind of beating around the bush when it comes to treatment and recovery.
That's right. And I don't think that recovery can exist outside of being direct. There's no, because the disease itself is direct. And I believe that there is something outside of your core being that is trying to literally starve you, similar to a virus or a cancer or an issue that's so pointed towards your demise. It's not going to go away. And that scares people. That scared me a lot, is being really honest and direct, because that's where we feel safe a lot of the time, is like being able to lie to ourselves, because the truth is a lot harder to work through. But I did not find recovery until I looked at that truth with you. And not just you, working with a team of people, which brings me to another important part of your practice, is working with a nutritionist and not just working with you as a therapist. So, why do you believe in that very direct, team-oriented approach?
I mean, having the team is essential, and that includes a physician, that includes a dietitian, an individual therapist, and sometimes it includes like a family, couples therapist for those that are involved, because the eating disorder is like a family illness. It affects everyone around you. And so having that team, it's important, because also you need to have, let's be real, you have to have your weight monitored. You have to have these things. You have to have a meal plan in place. You have to have someone who's keeping you accountable in that. And sometimes I mean, if I did both, that could hinder our relationship. Mm. If I'm the one, you're coming into therapy, which is a safe place that you're going to talk about your feelings. And then I'm like, okay, jump on the scale. We need to increase this. You need to eat more of that. That would totally hinder the therapeutic relationship that we have.
Right.
And so having a separate for those things, it's just kind of keeping these things separate for you helps to begin to separate the different aspects of what the eating disorder encompasses also, because it becomes kind of this enmeshed thing within itself and within you. And so by having these separate eyes on you, it gives more accountability for you to continue being kind of good to yourself and in recovery, but it also helps kind of separate these things to say, okay, there are different components. I can work on this, but still struggle with this. And that's not a bad thing.
Yes, absolutely. The compartmentalizing, as we've reiterated so many times, is potent in recovery. And because I don't think that we are humans of just like one compartment, and your health is not just one box. Your health has to be taken care of mentally, physically, emotionally, relationally, and recovery literally cannot happen unless you take on all of those, which anyone listening to this, I know that it sounds, it sounds like a lot, and that's because it is a lot. And it's not, this isn't like an exciting, fun thing to talk about. And something that I loved working with you is being able to integrate humor, being able to integrate, why do you think so many like comedians are funny, right? The saying is a comedian usually like has had to go through trauma or like has had to have like a hard time, because you have to laugh. Otherwise, you're just going to continue to sweep it under the rug and it's going to backtrack you, right? It's either going to unravel, or it's going to ravel your recovery. So what, and this is a loaded question, but what is recovery to you in your terms?
Recovery is different for everybody. Recovery changes probably every single day. I think the most important part of getting to a place to be in recovery is being medically stable, being at that place where you're not in a treatment facility, whether that's inpatient, outpatient, intensive outpatient. But I would expect recovery to begin and grow in an outpatient setting. So I think it's where someone's actively working to push back on these eating disorder urges and behaviors. The thoughts, like I said earlier, are usually the last part of the eating disorder to resolve. So while you're in recovery, I would hope that it's understanding these thought patterns, processing through the distortions, and how you can change, kind of align, what are my values and how are my behaviors affecting these values?
Yeah.
So recovery, it's really understanding all of that to really better understand how are these thoughts influencing my behaviors. Mm. This thing I always tell everyone, and especially when I work with families in actual treatment, is relapse is part of recovery. I said before, eating disorders are like the tip of the iceberg is the eating. You can eat, and that doesn't mean that you're in recovery for your eating disorder. You get through treatment and they put you on this meal plan and you're making all of your meals because you have to. But relapse is part of recovery, and that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I feel like as long as there's an active attempt to push back, to minimize and really communicate all the thoughts, urges, and behaviors, mm-hmm. that is when you're kind of in this recovery spot. I love working in all aspects of recovery. When I work with them in the treatment facility, like I start out with them in that inpatient setting. And so being able to walk along them throughout that, it's really rewarding. And you really see like, okay, this is the struggle. And then you see the progress and like getting to that point when they're ready to discharge, you're kind of like, sometimes I sit with them and I'm like, let's talk about where you were at however long ago. And let's talk about all this progress you've made. And like, you still have a long road ahead, but don't overlook, because it gets discouraging, right? Because then they go through the treatment program and then they're like, okay, I'm leaving. It should be easy. It should be fun. And it's like the hard work is really going to start, because essentially they're in this little, yeah. And like, essentially they're in this little safety bubble. All their triggers have been taken away. All these outside influences have been taken away. All of a sudden they're eating. And so I always like to emphasize with parents too, is like, this is the beginning of it. We got you here to stabilize. We got you here to bring some awareness. And that's why I also love being able to work with people outpatient too, because it's not as intensive as mm-hmm. being in treatment, right? Mm-hmm. I get to sit back, and I think in outpatient, people are a little more honest in their urges and their behaviors, because I think the fear is if they talk about them in treatment, they're going to stay there longer. Mm-hmm. So the beauty of having both is like being able to continue with people outside of it too, and saying, okay, let's get real here. Mm-hmm. Like, I know you're still having these urges and maybe you weren't talking about them before, but this is how we go forward.
Mm-hmm. And something about your approach in particular that really saved me was going to therapy for someone that loves to dissect and like talk about emotions and like dig really deep. It was important to me, and I didn't know how important it was to me to talk to someone that didn't, in the best way, didn't really care about my psychoanalysis of myself, right? Like it was really refreshing, I guess, to speak with someone who their superpower was being able to look you in the eye and ask me honestly, why did you do this? Or what was your thought process through this? Not what your heart was feeling. Because yeah. I do think that it is easier to try to diagnose yourself or like try to like feel your way through it, because that's kind of what eating disorders fester on, is your feelings. And, you know, how are you feeling? And then how can you control your eating habits? It was difficult for me, at least, to make the distinction between my head and my heart. And I think that's kind of what saved me. You were able to implement so much hope into me because you could like untangle all of those different thoughts and emotions and being like, no, this is what you're thinking and this is what you're feeling. And those are not the same things, because how you feel about a number on a scale isn't an accurate barometer, like you said, of your worth or like of, you know, who you are as a person. It's like, can we just look at this on like almost a scientific level, like a very candid level of like, you're underweight and this is what we need to do about it. We need to unravel in this way. Or like, you're overweight, which is a completely different, you know, it's the same thing. Like, eating disorders are eating disorders, whether that's overeating or undereating or distorted eating. So wrapping up a little bit, what is the most rewarding part of your job?
Seeing the journey. Obviously at this moment, hearing from somebody who I've actually worked with and hearing that impact, right? Like, sometimes that's forgotten. And I think with eating disorders, it's really slow. You don't just come and it doesn't just get fixed. It's like sometimes years and years and years of a lot of hard work. And so sometimes for my clients, and even for me, it's kind of like, okay, what are we doing? Where are we going? And sometimes taking that step back to say, no, we've made a lot of progress. Mm-hmm. And seeing that and hearing that. But I do definitely I have seen and I've experienced it while working at the hospital, and just seeing this progress throughout their time there. And then I see it in outpatient too. And so that truly is like the most rewarding part of knowing, almost every single time I leave a session, I'm like, okay, I made an impact. Like, this feels good. Like, this is working, and it's working for them. And I take a lot of pride in it. And so that's really definitely what keeps me going. And I absolutely love my job and everything about it. And it's really just knowing that I'm here for those people. And I appreciate the candid and the honesty, and especially everything that you're sharing today. This exactly is what keeps me going.
You know, looking back, and this will be my first time speaking about this part of me publicly, which, darkness can exist within light, but I also don't think hope can exist in darkness. So being able, along the common thread of honesty and being candid, I appreciate you being honest and being candid about your experience and working with people, because what you do changes the world. It's changed me and it's changed my world. And I think when one person's life can change, everyone around them changes as well. So recovery isn't just, oh, like I've hit a healthy number on a scale, which like that's an entirely different conversation of just like what is healthy and like what is BMI and like all of that. But being able to, I woke up metaphorically and literally the other day and realized that I wanted to live, that I had blood running in my veins and like my hair wasn't falling out and my stomach wasn't growling and I didn't have the urge to harm myself or restrict myself in any way, that it's priceless. No number on a scale is going to make me feel better about myself. Having the will to live makes me happy, you know, and like is as silly as that sounds, having hope is recovery, I think.
Yeah.
Wow. Mandy, I appreciate you taking time for like me to get to ask you questions. What a table turn. I remember so many times sitting in your office being stunted at some of the things that you said to me. And I was like, this girl's going to make me bite my tongue off. Ironically enough. So thank you for being honest and speaking so openly and candidly to myself and to everyone who's listening. My last question for you today, Mandy, is if you could tell your younger self anything today, what would you tell her?
I would tell her not to be afraid to just do it. I think so many times I was afraid of kind of, what would my family say if I made this decision? What would my friends say if I made this decision? And I think doing it, because eventually I would do it, but there was a lot of hesitancy. And I feel like every risk that I've ever taken has worked out for me. Things have just fallen into place. And I love that. And there was a lot of fear in that in my younger self. And so just knowing, like, do it. You can always bounce back. And I always have bounced back if it didn't work. But 9 times out of 10, the big risk that I've taken has really worked out for me. And so never to underestimate my resiliency.
You are the poster child of resiliency and like being candid. And I think that is, you know, I know that your work as a therapist is like one thing, but I also getting to listen to you, you're a role model. You're someone who leads by example, that this integrity in your life is, it's important to have someone to help you that also has helped themselves and like really takes care of themselves and like has that superpower of resiliency. So overall, I guess, thank you for existing. Thank you for being you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mandy, if you don't mind telling us a little bit about White Rock Creek and how to get connected with you, where we can find you.
Yeah, so it's a practice that is owned by Kelsey Haka. We currently are of 3, and we're here in Plano, Texas. We have our website, whiterockcreektherapy.com, and currently accepting clients always, right? So we all specialize in eating disorders, and we all share that passion together.
Yes, thank you. And I will make sure to link below how you can come in contact with Mandy and her team. But yeah, anyone who's listening to this that has struggled with disordered eating or knows someone that has, someone that you love and that you care about, I cannot recommend enough having the courage to reach out, even taking the first step of researching into what it would look like, because you're deserving of life and you're deserving of recovery even when it's scary. And that's something that Mandy has taught all of us today, is that risks are worth it, even when you don't know what the road ahead looks like. It's just, what's the next best thing? So thank you everyone for listening. Thank you, Mandy, for coming on today. And we will see you guys next time on Cageless.
If you enjoyed or learned anything from today's episode, I want to hear from you. Shoot me a text or call to 903-871-5092. is completely free and anonymous if you choose. You can also shoot me an Instagram DM, that's in the show notes, or follow along with the Cageless newsletter. And don't forget to be kind to yourself today.